Okay, so can we just talk then about something we alluded to before, this notion of economic cleansing. That was one of the things that struck me around the Seaside Sanctuary. It's part of that whole process where we don't have the diversity of the community if we can't have an old people's home on the island.
There's something fundamental about a community being able to care for its elderly. I've always had a feeling that to some degree we're punished by the city for living here, and there's an element of, you know, not liking the idea of the renegade community, the difficult community that is always arguing, that is always complaining, that doesn't know when it's got it good. And when you complain to the city, a lot of the responses are imbued with this kind of idea that you chose to live out there, as if this is some sort of retreat for the idle and the wealthy, and increasingly it is, don't get me wrong, but it is also and has always been a sanctuary for other sorts of people, and way back in the early 20th century it was a sanctuary for merchant seamen, and so they would get a sort of retirement package of some sort. They'd still be at sea, but they're maybe because they were merchant seamen, they were saving all their money and not spending it. And it was very, very popular with the merchant seamen to buy sections on Waiheke Island. And in fact, the first house I bought here in 1990, mid-90s, I looked back on the original ownership papers, and the first owner of the property was a merchant seaman who had made his investment in a little piece of land on an offshore island, probably because it was all he could afford. And it was somewhere for him to go when his merchant seaman career was over, and to retire. And there was a lot of those on the island. And then through the various generations, the island community is transient more than most, and so the nature of the island changed. But it was always a sanctuary of some sort. It's been a sanctuary for those in need of care for psychological reasons, not so much care, but sanctuary. It's always been a place for, it's been a working class sanctuary, retreat for many, many generations. And then, of course, there was
You see, it's interesting.
All right, I'll say it, the hippies.
Yeah.
I was trying to find a better word, but there was the sort of 60s, the 60s and 70s. Those people seeking a sanctuary from the rat race and from capitalism and from all the pressures of the mainland. And then it became a sort of, I guess I was part of the tail end of that, came to the island and sort of had an idea that this would protect me from the rat race, and it has. And then we were followed by the next lot, and then ultimately by the Nouveau Riche, are now on the hillsides around the island. But I argue that the other people haven't left. It has
absolutely, and it's quite interesting though, because I take your point about sanctuary, but I also think that, you know, it's a choice. I came here and I felt it was a choice. I had the choice to be in the inner city if I'd wanted to. I came as an immigrant and I chose to come and live here, and I chose to come and live here for quite specific reasons.
Well, it's certainly,
and it bothers me that now I'm told, well, you know, if you can't afford to live here, you should go somewhere else.
Yeah, well, I guess
as opposed to, you know, just as you say, you know, protecting what we have and saying, you know, we came here because we want it to be a natural environment, and we should continue to be able to do that.
It's certainly that. One of the immigration moments that I didn't mention is perhaps people like yourself, Shirin, who have come from other parts of the world and found Waiheke. And there's, you know, everybody knows, there's a lot of people on the island in that category. A lot of people who have come to live in New Zealand and probably come to Auckland and thought, well, that's a boring little town, isn't it? But how about that really lovely island just offshore? And there's a lot of international people from all around the world who have settled here, and I celebrate that. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I've got Italian friends, German friends, English friends, French friends, and they all live within, you know, 10 miles of me. That's absolutely fantastic. So that's another group. But I guess the point I'm trying to get to is that despite that transience, despite that wave after wave of migration to Waiheke, I'm strongly of the view that it's a solid community that has the right to be here, and we have the right to be born here. I've had one child born here. My older daughter was about 2 when we came here. She's now 17. She's been at every educational institute on Donald Bruce Road, from the creche to the kindy to the primary school to the intermediate, and now she's in her last year of high school.
Isn't it?
It's absolutely lovely. So Rose, my daughter, is a genuine Waiheke Islander. She's grown up here. Mm. She has every right to die here if she wants. And this community and the wider community that should support this community should make sure there's the infrastructure for her to do that. And if Seaside Sanctuary is closing down, and I realise there are real economic issues behind that. I'm not blaming anybody, except perhaps I'm railing at the system that doesn't allow for that privilege of community over economics. Mm. And if we don't make room in our economic system for that, then we're going to just turn Waiheke into a playground. It's going to be a Martha's Vineyard eventually, where people come from Auckland to work on the roads or serve the coffee in the cafes or
which
clean the public toilets.
Doing.
Well, I'm on the wharf every morning, and it's mostly chippies and
but tradesmen. Still, it's a shame that there isn't space that they can, you know, live here as well.
I don't think they want to. I think they just quite like the idea of working here.
Well,
and you know, I think migratory labour goes both ways. We have, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 people every day go to
absolutely,
town to work,
but the migrators this way tend to be a bit, you know,
a bit more servicey.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Than the ones coming the other way.
Yeah.
The other issue around the Seaside Sanctuary, I spent quite a lot of time on the phone last night and this morning trying to work out who could come on and talk on the issue of the sanctuary, and it was impossible to get anyone who would come and talk who actually has any power to make decisions on that issue. But they did say that one of the things they're up against is finding good personnel, and if they could perhaps find good personnel or a good manager, they might be able to keep it open for another couple of years. So I think, and from what I could understand, they were quite open to the idea of doing that, and maybe they hadn't realized the wealth of feeling in support of the Seaside Sanctuary, but now perhaps as they're realizing how you know what a huge respect we have for that institution, they're coming around to the idea that maybe they could perhaps try and get someone else in, and the problems with the building or other issues that they've got, which I'm not sure what they are, could perhaps be delayed for a little while if they can find the right person. So really the push is on, I think, to see if there's someone who can maybe take that role from Pat, who has you know, probably decided a long time ago that she no longer wanted to do it, but has just continued to do it because there was no one else.
Yeah.
And I think the other issue about the island, and I always think it's such a shame, and it's happened with certain businesses as well, is that, you know, people, you know, fulfill a function in the community, and institutions do, and then suddenly, you know, the trust or the people running it decide they haven't got any money, they can't sustain it anymore, and they just collapse. And it's always such a shame that it gets to that point, because I think we do have a really diverse community, and there's also a lot of money in the community, pockets of it in different places. Mm. And I think if we knew that things were struggling, it might be a possibility to turn things over to a community model or community support and still keep them going. And maybe we need to be thinking about more of those things into the future, as there does become more and more of a pressure on the services that we have to keep them going.
Are we saying then, though, that we can't be a self-generating community, that we need philanthropy and rich people to come here and fund our essential services? That sort of smacks.
No, I don't think it's philanthropy. I think it's you know, how can we? And I think, you know, maybe Auckland Council also have something, you know, should be saying something about this. But how do we make our community resilient? How do we make it so that, you know, it can provide for our economic, social, and cultural well-being,
which is what the Local Government Act says.
Over and over
Auckland Council should do, and I'm pleased to see that you know, albeit slightly late, the local board has said, okay, we need to look into this, and the politicians on the board have said it came as a complete surprise to them, and they had in fact heard earlier that there was going to be reinvestment in this, and that they needed a plan B because the current building has wastewater issues like every property on the island, and this needs a lot of investment in it, and they need a new nurse manager, and it all just became too much. But the board believed there was a plan B in the background, and as it turns out, there wasn't, or plan B was closing it down. Mm. We, of course, have a retirement village.
Yes.
And so there's this fundamental, if you leave the market to look after it, then there'll be some people who can afford to retire on Waiheke and some who can't. And if you leave it entirely to the market, then obviously places like Seaside Sanctuary are probably not going to survive. One of the things for me about Seaside Sanctuary is that it's utterly emblematic of the final frontier on the island, if you like. There's not many other properties so close to the water on the island that are dedicated to people who don't who didn't have the capital to invest in that property. So it's a very special place in that it's a stone's throw from the water for people in their dotage.
But I think the other thing about it is that it fulfills a lot of other functions. I mean, they run Meals on Wheels
there. Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
That provides a huge service to lots of people that we don't necessarily see, but are really, you know, benefiting sick people, elderly people. Yep. And it's all run through there. The other thing is, I mean, having been to a retirement home in France, which was just awful. There was just this gate, and you had to buzz, and then someone would come with a huge key and unlock it for you, and then there'd be all these, you know, extremely old people all cramped together,
like
sitting around waiting.
Hospital.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And here, you know, there are people who swim into their 80s and come and go as they like, and
absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
And having spent a bit of time there, it just seems like an incredibly, you know, if you had to go to a retirement home, it would be the place you'd want to go.
Absolutely.
And I think that as well as it means it's a shame for it to go.
Yeah, oh, it's terrible. And I guess, I mean, Dorian obviously is the figure that we're all thinking about. There are plenty more people who have been through Seaside Sanctuary and are still there than Dorian. But the idea that Dorian won't be able to live on Waiheke, she may be of an age where she needs care. That doesn't mean she should leave Waiheke. And we've seen it. I've seen it again and again over the years. People who have had to leave Waiheke, there either wasn't a bed at Seaside Sanctuary for them, or it didn't suit them for one reason or another. The thing is that if most people leave Waiheke in at the very elderly years, but those who are desperate to stay can, that's a healthy situation.
Oh, indeed. Okay. Well, anything else? You usually talk to us about... can we talk maybe something on the Pacific Forum? Or I've been quite interested in the Rugby World Cup. I mean, suddenly I've got rugby fever, so I've actually watched a couple of matches, which I never thought I'd see myself doing. But one of the things that happened at school that I thought was really lovely was this kind of notion, and happened in the community, society, is this notion of adopt a second team.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really special. I mean, what country in the world adopts a second team? Basically, you're out to win it. And yes, there is that kind of rhetoric from, you know, John Key around, you know, we're really supporting the All Blacks, and he always manages to get that in there, you know. But I think, you know, the rest of New Zealand, a lot of us are kind of, it's just interesting that there's this kind of support for other teams as well.
For John Key, it's a brand.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so that's a bit tragic, to be honest. But look, I've got excited by the rugby too, but one of the things I love about this particular World Cup is actually if the All Blacks falter, if they trip up in the quarters or the semis, I'm not going to be heartbroken. It's an amazing festival of rugby. Everybody's from all over the world here. In the last World Cups, we went there, and if we lost it, we were heartbroken. Well, we did lose it, and we were heartbroken. And this time, there's a lot to celebrate other than the success or failure of the All Blacks, and so it's a party at our place, which I guess is you know,
which I think people are really enjoying.
People are realizing that this isn't all about the All Blacks.
No,
and
lots of people are kind of you know, enjoying the fact that the matches are coming to their town.
Yeah,
or, you know,
absolutely.
There was a great feeling I saw on TV in Hamilton around the match last night, and it was really lovely. There seemed to be like some New Zealanders, some people who were supporting the Japanese or just really pleased that they were scoring something, and then there were some Japanese kind of dressed up in all black colours.
No, there's a boundary. Even though we're desperately passionate about our own teams and you know, the Italian and French and American supporters in Auckland are, you know, wearing their colours and talking their talk, but when it comes down to it, this is actually a border breaking down event, an event that breaks the borders. I've met more people
as long as New Zealand wins, of course.
No,
then we
but
can all
I guess
break down the borders with
no. I guess that's
light.
My
no,
point. But I guess that's my point is that sure, I want the All Blacks to win. That's just because I'm a Kiwi, so I want the All Blacks to win. But if they don't, I will have met dozens of people from various places. I chatted with some Argentinians at Tuero Island on that disastrous opening night. You know, and I've met French, and I've even said good luck to an Australian.
Do you think the foreigners thought it was that disastrous?
No, I don't think so.
I think the foreigners are like, well, you know, it's a big crowded place, things go wrong, get over it. Yeah. And I think it's, from what I can gather, it seems to be more the sort of New Zealanders that are all wringing their necks and, you know,
wringing their necks.
Not their necks, their but, you know, wringing yeah. their hands and yep. kind of going, oh, you yep. know, what's gone wrong? And then the other side of that is like, well, what do you think's gone wrong? You know, Len Brown suggested an improvement in the rail service, and the rail service has only got about 2 trains and 4 buses for 120,000 people. And if you don't upgrade the public transport, which is what the super city was supposed to promise us,
yeah, right.
then things like this happen. I know. Yeah.
And the argument of one of the arguments I've heard going around the place in the last week or so, of course, is that the government is quite pleased this has happened. It's allowed it to step in and look like a government.
So patronising, isn't it? That thing of we're stepping in.
I know, to step in and take control in election year. Is just how John Key wants to be seen.
Yeah.
When something goes wrong, he'll take control and he'll fix it, or Murray McCulley. And another thing, and of course, I think another argument, I don't really know whether this is right or not, but there's an argument going around that they're very happy for Len Brown to fail here because they don't really want that liberal-style mayoralty after the next. I mean, they had to tolerate the fact that he came up from South Auckland with a whole lot of South Auckland votes and won the bloody mayoralty, you know?
Mm.
And they had to tolerate that, even though Rodney Hyde and John Key had set up the super city in a way that was an anathema to many of the sort of liberal principles of devolving power to people.
Mm. And they've also sort of positioned him as being, as Auckland Council, having failed in their public transport obligations.
I'm sorry, I think it's the council-controlled organisations that have failed.
Yeah.
And those are the very political structures that many left and liberal people disagreed with, the idea of semi-privatisation of essential community services.
But it's also, if you don't fund them properly, then you don't move forward on the issues that you on the platform, which was to improve public transport, which hasn't actually happened.
Mm.
You know, we haven't got integrated ticketing. That was promised to us before the super city.
Mm.
They've had a couple of years now to sort that out, and surely they should have been. They've had that council controlled organisation for 2 years now, and they knew it was in the pipeline. They knew that public transport was an issue, and yet there is still no integrated ticketing. I lived in Barcelona just before the Olympics, and the infrastructure improved dramatically.
Mm.
And it wasn't just flowers and roundabouts. It was actually, you know, concrete. You know, there was an extension to the underground, and it, you know, extended another 10 stations, and it went out to the airport, and there were just a lot of things that happened.
And it worked.
Of course it did.
Because you can't have a public transport system that grows in an ad hoc fashion. You can't have it. It needs to be planned. I mean, the idea of Auckland actually being planned, that seems to be to most local governments, most councils that I've been aware of ever since, you know, Robbie onwards, seem to think that planning is some communist plot.
Yeah. And so what do you make of the super city? I mean, you're not working at the Gulf News now, but presumably you have some sort of insight into what's going
I don't know about insight. I never sort of thought I had that much insight into local government. There's a lot that goes on behind closed doors that journalists just don't even get close to.
Mm.
The super city, I think, is it's not all bad. It may be turning out all bad, but it wasn't necessarily all bad, potentially.
I have to say, the libraries, it's all good.
Yeah, exactly.
The libraries
There's
are
a good
fabulous.
Example. There's a good example. That the turning of downtown Auckland into a more human-focused space, and I use it every day, has been absolutely marvellous. I basically don't have to stop walking from my office opposite Aotea Square until I'm on the ferry. I mean, I might have to for a minute. But otherwise, there's a pedestrian crossing or these new shared spaces that let me get through to somewhere. There's all sorts of stuff that have made the inner city a more humanistic place, a more people-scaled place. And I think that's the super city. And I hope that it's happening in Papakura and on the North Shore. And I suspect it isn't. and I don't really want to see Central Auckland get all the investment. But it's not a bad place to start. And we've now got an inner city that feels like an inner city, that feels increasingly like an inner city. You might even have some performance spaces in public. You might have places that buskers can enjoy instead of just being a nuisance to the crowd, which is how Auckland Council seems to see busking and performing.
Mm. Well, it would be interesting to see what happens to this, what's it called, the cloud and that other wharf that, Macaulay's just decided to open up.
That's particularly for the World Cup. But after the World Cup, we're going to have the Wynyard Quarter to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only been through the Wynyard Quarter once. I never got there on the opening night of the World Cup because it was just too busy to get down there. But I did go through the Wynyard Quarter at 7:30 in the morning, having got on sort of on automated response and got up too early and got on an early ferry and thought, why am I on such an early ferry? Oh, well, I'll go down the Wynyard Quarter. And this was 7:30 in the morning on a weekday, and there was basically nobody there. It was just a few days before the Cup started. And it's an absolute... I just encourage people who haven't been down there yet to go and have a look.
I mean, I think that's the other thing about New Zealand is that the critical mass sometimes is maybe... there's a lovely festive atmosphere now, but outside of that, is it always going to be an area that isn't really populated because people are going to be, out on their barbecue in the back lawn rather than coming into the central city to enjoy that? And it's not that populated?
No, it's early days for the Wynyard Quarter. I think the Wynyard Quarter is what the viaduct has needed. It's a public space that isn't sort of dominated by these expensive apartments. I think that people will enjoy it. I think you provide the infrastructure, people will come. And I think that they have provided a pretty lovely open space.
I must go down and see it.
You haven't been down?
No, I haven't.
You see, what
down.
I found...
See, that's the problem because I...
Yeah, sure. And after the World Cup, we'll all get down there and we'll start to use it. Look, it's not... it's not Manukau City. It's not really... It's pretty Pluty. I think... And there's been comments I've heard about the restaurants being fairly expensive. But nevertheless...
You can still hang out there.
Oh, look, and it's...
You hang out in the centre of Barcelona, but it didn't mean that you were necessarily eating or drinking or whatever.
No,
you could just walk around and see things.
There are lovely parks for children. There's an integration of some of the old concrete towers into the space. So you get to the end of the Wynyard Quarter and there's these two fantastic sort of sculptural shapes ahead of you. They're big old concrete towers. I'm not talking about the tank farm. That's another step. But at the end of the Wynyard Quarter, there are these two archaic and old things that... It's sort of about 150 feet high in the air. And on the way down there, there's lovely public spaces. And I guess what I feared for the Wynyard Quarter was that it was going to be naff. And it's only an opinion, and other people may think it's naff, but I don't. They've done some really interesting stuff, like taking some of the old concrete structures that were there before and integrating them into the landscaping, and not in a crude way. I mean, they are crude, in a positive use of the word crude, but they're not ugly. And the cobblestones, the planting is all native. The parks have got this maritime theme. If you walk down there, there's a container theme. So if you need to get $20 out from the cash point machine is actually in an old shipping container. There are toilets in a shipping container. There's an information booth in a shipping container. So they've kept an Auckland ports theme all the way down there, and 15 steps.
And recycled some of those containers.
And recycled some of those containers, exactly. And 15 or 10 steps from these Pluty restaurants are Auckland's lovely, authentic fishing boats. So you can see the fishing boats come and go. It's not... I think it's fantastic. I'm a huge fan of the Wynyard Quarter. As I say, I've only been there once, and you're right, Sharon. It will be interesting to see how we use it.
Great, yeah. Now, can I just ask you one other thing about the Rugby World Cup? It's the specific thing.
Yeah.
Which is that the other thing that really struck me was the fact that all these, things like Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, they've got, we always say that there's the greatest number of, islanders off the islands live in New Zealand.
Mm. It's the world's biggest Polynesian city.
Mm. And you really feel that energy of the World Cup being in this part of the world. And it's just, the other fabulous thing I've felt is that just seeing all the Fijians and the Tongans especially out in force. Yeah. And just such a lovely energy around them playing, and such a great sort of feeling of confidence.
Yeah. Oh, the Tongan confidence was incredible before the first game, wasn't it? I wonder if one of the great mistakes that that the bureaucrats made in the organisation of the opening night of the World Cup was they forgot it was Tonga playing the All Blacks. They didn't look at the schedule and realise that, the Tongan Cup community from South Auckland was heading into town. Now, if it had been, you know, the opening game obviously has to be the host team, but say Auckland was playing, New Zealand was playing Japan on the first opening night of the World Cup, you wouldn't have had those crowds, would you? You would have had crowds, but this was the 10% they forgot about, or if you ask me. How silly was that not to think that the whole Tongan community from South Auckland was coming in with flags and an attitude to play the All Blacks, you know, and they weren't going to sit at home and watch it on telly, no way. And we knew this from days out, but perhaps somebody should have realised it from months out.
Yeah.
I mean, they did have 4 years to get this right.
Yeah.
And look, I don't think it was a huge disaster. There was an awful traffic accident. It was a really awful traffic accident where 6 people were injured. And I think some were very badly injured, and I hope they're recovering.
Oh, look, it's great. And we've still got a few more matches to enjoy. And like people like me who never, ever go watch rugby because I can't, you know, it's, you know, people running up and down with the ball. I'm actually really into it.
It's fantastic. as somebody sort of elderly-ish within the area I work said to me recently, oh, I don't really like rugby, but I'm up for a carnival.
I
guess that's what's drawing us all in,
I guess it was the America's Cup, wasn't it? The last time.
Yeah, but that was super elite. I mean, we love yachting as New Zealanders, but that was the Formula One of yachting, and the World Cup is not the Formula One of rugby. It's the every game. It's the everyman game of rugby, where everybody from Russia playing in their first World Cup. I have to admit, I'm going to the Australian Ireland game this afternoon.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've just got given a ticket by a family member who found they had a spare one, and yeah, I'm off to Eden Park today, and I'm sort of slightly fearful, to be honest, but also quite excited. I want to see the new Eden Park.
Do you like rugby, or is it?
Yeah, I like rugby. I'm not an expert in rugby. I'm just an armchair kind of fan. I watch the All Blacks, and I might watch Auckland. I've only actually been to one live game at North Shore, the North Harbour Stadium, when I saw Auckland spank Canterbury 36-6 in the Super 15 or Super 12 it was back then. And Joe Rakitika scored a try about 3 metres from us, and it was pretty exciting.
Wow, I saw lots of people going down to the Bledisloe Cup. And that was amazing, just seeing so many, you know, families going down. Because for me, I have an association with sport, and, you know, especially international sport, as being something that you don't take your families to, you don't take your kids to.
Mm.
I mean, I was amazed that so many people went to the opening night of the World Cup, because it would never have occurred to me to take children to an event that would have so many people potentially getting drunk, lots and lots of crowds. But I think maybe in New Zealand there isn't an association with sport and violence and lots of drunken youth to party.
Not the same way there is in other places, that's right. Although there were some pretty drunk young people around on Friday night. I didn't see any violence, but I saw a fair amount of kind of unsavory behavior, but you know, that's alcohol, isn't it? And
so the other scoop for AUT and Pacific Media was the Pacific Media Centre supported Scoop, because I was actually looking at Scoop going, oh my god, they're doing so much here, and it's really interesting news about the Pacific, and who are all these names? And then I got an email from David Roby saying, oh, you know, we've been supporting Scoop, and that's the Pacific Media Centre at AUT, and they've just been doing a great job, and I think they're also coming of age, you know, they're it seems that they've got a little bit of status around covering Pacific media issues.
Absolutely. And David Roby's a phenomenal workhorse. The man's a champion. He's so dedicated to this project, the Pacific Media Center. You can see his light on late into the night, you know, most days. He's an extremely hardworking individual, and a fantastic journalist in his younger days, and an incredibly motivated academic these days.
And very committed, as
And he set up the Pacific Media Centre at AUT a few years ago. It's part of the school where I work, and it has a kaupapa that's quite interesting, because it's a mix of reporting on the Pacific, of reporting on Pacific media issues, and of, if you like, promoting Pacific issues and arguing for diversity in various places within New Zealand society, and primarily the media, of course, which is generally acknowledged as being in pretty need of increased diversity and, you know, is not representative of the community.
I remember at the investigative journalism conference that I think he organised last year, there was someone there from the Solomon Islands, and one of the debates that came up was the issue around maybe if they'd had a stronger media, they would have been able to preempt some of the violence in the Solomon Islands and been able to, you know, challenge some of the myths that were being circulated and some of the you know, anti-Chinese sentiment that they had had and some of the tribal difficulties that they'd had.
This is really interesting for me. I'm at the front end of my PhD, and this is the area that I'm very interested in. I grew up in the Pacific, and I'm by no means an expert on the Pacific, but I guess you become an expert by starting somewhere, and that's where I'm at. And David is a bit of a mentor for me in this area because he's researched Pacific media issues for so many years now, and he's not the only one. There are some pretty cool experts around Australia and New Zealand in this area. But what I'm interested in is new media. I teach new media. That's kind of I'm not such a geek as Country Mike in a technical sense, but I'm very interested in online journalism. It was mentioned at this conference yesterday that daily newspapers have got 5 years. So we've got to work out how we're going to make online journalism pay under a capitalist model, or how we're going to create an infrastructure that supports it. It doesn't pay. That's the big problem, that there's no money in online journalism at the moment. Advertising is leaving mainstream newspapers, but it's not going to online newspapers. What I'm interested in is my first question was, can new media in the South Pacific, is it connecting far-flung communities in the Pacific, or is it leaving them behind? Because it's all very well to talk about the ease of digital communication, but if in your village you've got one dial-up connection or no connection, then new media is irrelevant. So
absolutely, and again, it becomes, well, whose media is it? Is it the media of the elite, or is it the media of the population?
Which is the
and
very...
And whose messages are you communicating?
That's
if
right.
only certain people can access it, and certain people have certain, you know...
And that's the very moment that you start talking about social media. And I'm very interested in this. There's an Australia... The Pacific editor of The Australian, which is a newspaper called The Australian, Rowan Garrick, recently wrote a very interesting piece about what Melanesian societies occasionally refer to as big man power. So the bigger you are, the more power you have, and the less sort of you have to answer to people. That's kind of the systems. I mean, this is very dangerous to generalize across Pacific countries and even within Melanesia. But what he's arguing is that social media is kind of undermining that now. And you know, Pacific governments are famous for not really promoting or championing free speech. And there's not just by Naram. I'm not just talking about Fiji. All over the Pacific, there are examples where editors have been beaten up or deported for saying the wrong thing, or aren't. You know, there's in some countries like the Cook Islands, there's officially an Official Information Act, but it's just never used. It's never really acknowledged. There's the idea of an open society that the West so likes to press on other places. You know, and I'm an advocate of open society, don't get me wrong, but you know, there's another argument that's saying that the more we try and force a Western model of media in these countries, the more we're just disrupting things. And in steps social media, and people in according to the editor of the Pacific editor of The Australian, women in particular, but all sorts of places within Pacific society are being opened up through communication channels. You don't need permission to get on Facebook. If you can get onto the internet, you can communicate with other people across the Pacific who are facing the same issues as you. You can organize yourself. You can discuss issues without having to go through the mainstream media, which is, as I said, often under the cosh from government. So you have government beating up on the media, and then ordinary people discussing things among themselves. That seems a pretty fertile ground for change, if you ask me. And as I said, I'm just at the front end of my research, but that's where I'm starting, and that's what I'm interested in. So the Pacific Islands Forum. Well, You're right.
Let me just
sure.
play a track. Just break it up a little bit. Because I'm sure people are thinking, oh my God, this is quite intense.
Stop talking.
Stop talking. So, Talking Heads, Take Me to the River. And then we'll come back, see if there's something else you'd like to mention.
Thank you.
Okay,
no,
well,
it wasn't great. It was dreary. You said it was dreary.
Yes, I did say it was dreary. I was told point blank at some point not to say that I'd put on dreary music if I didn't like a track.
But let's face it, yes. You just put on whatever's next in the queue, Sharon.
That's right. I sometimes do, and that was an example of that. Great. Okay. Well, look, we've talked about lots of different things. I just wanted to finish off with something that I never read to Basil Holmes, but I thought he would have quite enjoyed. It's from a book by Julia Sutherland, who's a New Zealand author who lives in the South Island, The Spell of Morpheus. And it's about a woman who lives in Southerton in the South Island, the bottom of the South Island, I think.
Sounds as if it's at the bottom of the South Island, Southerton.
Yes, you would think,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah.
And I just think he would have enjoyed this, so I'll just read it. So Leah thought about some of those small boys from the old neighbourhoods who went to university, became rich, and now ruled the land. With never a single thought about serving society, they instead played Monopoly in reality and amassed swimming pools of money, which 1,000 people could not spend in one lifetime. And she thought they might have forgotten, or perhaps they'd never heard, that oppression was a tool of the tyrants they were in danger of becoming, and there was little left of the once proud, egalitarian society which nurtured them and their children into the state they now found themselves in, and over which they had so much control. With all that power, they could go by night and, like Santa Claus, leave money in the letterboxes of families with small children, because research now said that too many children lived in poverty. Or they might finance job schemes for the unemployed to give them hope, or go into schools and plant libraries, or trees and bare playgrounds to play in, or make whatever magic they wanted. But, she imagined, and she wished she could be proved wrong, they loved money more than anything, and hardly could be parted from it. They would spend all their time counting and growing it, measuring and stroking it, leaping and diving into the deep well of notes. And the reason I think he would have liked that is he always had a deep distrust of people who amassed wealth,
yeah,
for no particular reason than just the fact that they wanted to have more. And it's an interesting thing, you know, how much is enough money, really?
The whole principle of surplus value, just to sort of tie up everything we've talked about this morning, would have appalled Basil, the idea that you take surplus value and stick it in your own bank account instead of empowering the community with it. He was a man of community, and I think that was lovely, absolutely lovely. I look out for the author. I don't know her at all.
Well, I picked it up, I think, at Artworks or in a book sale or something. I just thought, oh, sort of caught my eye. But, you know, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. The other interesting thing is, again, it's this thing of it's a New Zealand author from the South Island. I mean, I'm not sure what else she's published or how you would find out about her. And I just love the idea of just, you know, that's the great thing about a book sale. You just go and you find things, yeah, that you never expected to find, and they're just a brilliant, brilliant read. Not recommended by anyone, but just lovely.
Maybe a little bit like your Saturday morning show. You just sort of find, you're just not sure what you're going to find or who's going to pop in or what kind of crazy stuff they're going to talk.
That's right. I was totally paranoid I wouldn't get anyone, and then suddenly at 10:15, there's a whole bunch of people standing there wondering when they're going to get a chance
to pay tribute to Basil. And yeah, well, look, it's a privilege to come in and be able to talk about stuff that you're passionate about. And as Country Mike said earlier, we're not allowed to know that Country Mike is actually Brent.
Right, okay, we'll just call him Donald.
As Donald said earlier on today, you know, Waiheke Radio provides an opportunity for, I'm always suspicious of the term alternative, but, you know, for the unheard voices or the out-crowded voices in the community. And Basil would have been a huge supporter of that concept. And indeed, we've talked about all sorts of stuff this morning, from political economy to Marx to Basil Holmes to rugby. And back again. And if I could just have one final thought before I leave your poor listeners alone. The idea, as I've discovered this week, in quite sharp relief, the idea that a political economy approach to communication in particular is very much coming back in vogue, and that the political economists who have been on the outer in intellectual spheres for a decade or two but have struggled on in the dark are now finding that with the, to be honest, with the crisis that capitalism is in, they're finding that their political economy approach is I wouldn't say in vogue, but it's certainly it's certainly receiving a lot more attention. And if Basil has departed this fine island, I hope he knew as he went that we're thinking increasingly the way he has thought for decades and decades. Mm. And on that happy note, I'll say goodbye.
Well, thank you, and viva la revolución.